The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. The Premier League, a season of crisis, rifts and underwhelming performances, but are Manchester United now good? A season of inconsistency, tactical mistakes and missing chances, but are Chelsea now good? Liverpool's choke is over, but will any fans be in the stadium when they lift the trophy? Elsewhere, Luke Ayling goes full Van Basten in the Championship, while Ellen White gives Phil Neville a much needed win in the She Believes Cup. Italy goes behind closed doors, Real lose, and there's some love for Rennes in France. That, plus your questions, Philippe's redacted FIFA Minute, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Hello, Philippe Auclair.
Hello, how are you?
It's nice to see you.
It's very nice to see you.
How much time will the lawyers be spending on today's pod?
Oh, not too long today.
Oh, that's good news.
We've got a train to catch, so I've got to be careful.
You're absolutely right. Television's Lars Sivertsen, hello.
It's very unfair.
I thought you did a marvellous job.
Thank
on
you
the
very
BT
much.
Sport
it was good
score.
Fun. Everyone were very nice. Mm.
And it is my fault that they knew that you liked it when people said you look like the games teacher from Grange.
Do I like it, Max?
I don't know. I didn't expect.
I think you're confusing me liking it with you liking it.
I didn't
which is
expect.
Similar, but not the same.
Yeah, I didn't expect Mark Pugacz when I said Lars is on and he's nice. He also really likes it when you point of, hey, looks like Mr. Baxter. I didn't expect it then to get to the big screen.
Yeah, but you know,
full screen on BT. There you are.
There we go.
Mark Langdon.
Hello, Max.
How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you.
Where have you had any kumquats recently?
No.
Broccoli?
No, absolutely not. No. The last thing I ate was some pork last night.
That's what it was. Was it cooked or just raw?
No. It was absolutely cooked with some roast potatoes and Yorkshire pudding.
Ooh.
See, everyone else is...
Mark's
panic buying is just the meat. It's just the meat section, isn't it? Right. Anyway, here we all are to do a podcast for you. And we'll begin at Old Trafford, Manchester United 2, Manchester City 0, goals from Martial and McTominay, sealing that derby win for United. Interesting Pep stats. He's never lost more league matches in a single season during his managerial career than this one. 7th defeat so far. Was this simply that United wanted it more? On the TV in the UK, Philippe, on Sky, that was the sort of vibe they were giving out, that it just mattered more to United, given that, you know, City are in the top four and can't get anywhere else.
I'm not really sure about that. I don't think they wanted it less than Manchester United. They were curiously toothless when they approached the goal, but the approach play was actually of very, very good quality for most of the game. And I think it's one of those games where we will be tempted to read it with a kind of scoreline lens. And because of McTominay scoring in the last second, 2-0 looks like a significant victory. But we should not forget Manchester United's single goal came from a free kick routine. I mean, I don't want to, you see where I'm going here. But I don't want to be too hard on this direction. I think perhaps we're making a little bit too much of it. But they were excellent. What Manchester United is showing at the moment, and I'm sure we'll come to that, since they've got somebody who can actually dictate the play, particularly when they approach the opposition goal, it's that there is a genuine change there happening. And City were curiously listless up front. I thought as well that the team lineup was a little bit surprising, perhaps. It always is with Pep Guardiola. And, I'm not as convinced, perhaps, as people are looking at the press this morning, that we are on the verge of seeing Manchester United going back to become one of the big teams in England on the strength of this particular performance. They were good. They were not brilliant. They had some good moments. No? Am I too hard?
My next question is, are United good now? I mean, it's Solskjaer.
They were good.
You know, your compatriot, Lars. Is that his third win over
Pep? He has his critics, Solskjaer, and often I've been one of them, and I'm not going to pretend otherwise just because they won a game of football. But I think the tactically, the matchup was very, very good for them. We've seen it since literally the first day of the season, that in games when they can sit back a bit and soak up the pressure and hit people on the break, that's a tactical state that they're very comfortable in. But And I take what you say about the goal coming from a set piece and a goalkeeping error and the second goal being a goalkeeping error and extra time. But I also did think United looked sharper. Whether they wanted it more, I don't know. But there was more intent to what they were doing. They did seem to be putting a little bit more into the challenges. And you say the approach play was good, but there was something slightly anemic about Man City here. They didn't quite sort of have the zip in the passes. I think if Arsene Wenger was in charge, he'd say they lacked sharpness. I think
they played with the handbrake on, he would say.
That's another one, yeah. So I think it was the kind of the way the game played out. We saw a lot of the things that United are good at and have actually been good at all season. The direct counter-attacking, of course, with added Bruno Fernandes, which also helps. but it suited them really well, the way the game went.
It's so interesting with Fernandes, isn't it, how one piece of a jigsaw can appear to complete a puzzle that was impossible to complete.
I mean, Solskjaer said before the game that he's got his number 10 position nailed down now in terms of the team going forward, and I think Martial looks more comfortable. He's got somebody that can pass the ball forward to him. Fred and Matic look better because they've got somebody they can pass the ball short to, who can then dictate the play. I felt Manchester United maybe a little bit better than what Lars and Philippe were saying, actually, just in terms of I don't remember De Gea making sort of more than one save, really proper save in the whole game.
No, I mean, I agree. I think they did really well stopping City and making it difficult for them and letting them have the ball in areas of the pitch where it doesn't hurt anyone. And no, But what I'm saying is that it's not news that United are good at this, because for all the criticism Solskjaer has gotten, this is a side of them we've seen in most of the big games they've played.
But I felt against Liverpool, for instance, they played very similar and they got the 1-1 draw, and I didn't feel like they offered it anything really going forward, apart from the controversial goal that they scored in the first half of that game. Whereas I felt that particularly when they were on top against City, and they were on top at the time when they scored, they were creating chances. You know, there was a clear plan to expose Otamendi, particularly in Zinchenko. That wasn't a comfortable area at all for Manchester City. I felt that United under Solskjaer, this felt like a more complete performance than what
was it more complete than the win at the Etihad?
Yeah, because I felt like on that occasion that City were going to score.
I think City had more chances, did they not?
Yeah, they would knock. They would in that second half. I was convinced that City would pull it back at the Etihad, whereas Mahrez maybe turned the game a little bit when he came on, but never really felt like City were completely dominating.
But I guess the question you were asking was about Bruno Fernandes, and he has obviously slotted in fantastically. And the main criticism against United this season is that they can look a bit like they don't have much of a plan in possession, and then it obviously helps having a guy like him who's always making himself available, a guy who's not afraid to try the difficult pass. And you wonder, if he'd played for Man City for Pep Guardiola, I think he would have made Pep Guardiola his head explode, right? Because because Bruno Fernandes' pass completion is deceptively low. Like, he only completes about 75% of his passes. Like,
I think it's even fewer than that.
Something like one out of every four passes goes astray. Because, with Man City, they have this sort of very intricate system of zones across the pitch and where everyone's meant to go and where they're meant to pass the ball when people are in that position. Bruno Fernandes is more like, well, there's someone open on the other side of the pitch, I'm going to ping it over that way. And for Man United, a team that can look a little bit directionless sometimes and has done this season anyway, having a guy like him who will take on that responsibility, who has the vision obviously to spot a pass but also the technique to execute it and the personality to take on those sort of tricky things, has been a real godsend for them.
And if I can just go back to what Mark was saying about Martial, and it's Martial, not Martial, by the way. Sorry, it just annoys me.
You've been told there, Mark.
No, it's not you. It's especially TV commentators. Okay. I mean, it's Martial. Anyway, he really thrives on partnerships. And I think before that, one of the moments where he was the best at Manchester United was when he had this understanding with Romelu Lukaku. And they were really turning off each other's game really, really well, which is not necessarily the case when you have him with Rashford. The relationship is not quite the same. And here, yes, he has somebody to feed off. Also, I thought Martial's attitude surprised me, because I haven't been used to seeing him. You talk about greater aggression, and that, I think, a reason to be optimistic for them is that this kind of Martial I haven't seen very often. He was really engaged in the game, and he's a terrific finisher, as we know. He's a terrific dribbler and so forth, but there was much more to his game on that particular occasion. I'm sorry if I sounded a little bit too harsh on Manchester United
to
start
with. Too
late
now, Philippe.
No, it was because I think that, when we were watching the game, we felt when it was 1-0 that should Manchester City, who were then back on top, find a little bit of extra sharpness in the final third, they might actually probably win this game.
But actually, that I thought
they didn't.
I thought that was an interesting part of it, and it's something that we probably don't appreciate too much because it's not fascinating football. But Manchester United's organisation in that last half an hour, when City basically had the ball the whole time, and you have got to be on it. You know, every player needs to be so focused, all the time to think, am I in the right place? When do I go? When do I drop? And I thought United sort of, it looked to me like a sort of an exhibition of that kind of defensive play.
Yeah, and I'm sorry if it sounded dismissive when I said that this is something we know they do well. It's just, it is really hard. And I think for all of Solskjaer's flaws as a manager, and I'm sure he has a bunch, if you go through like the big games they've played this season, I think tactically they've set up quite well in most of them. I mean, and there is a skill to get making sure all the players are right on it and are disciplined and reacts to the right way in all the situations.
But they're fundamentally a counter-attacking team. Mm. So they're never better than when they're faced with a team which enjoys possession.
Mm-hmm. The key moments, was it a foul for the free kick? Fernandes goes down quite easily. Or is it a case of, well, even if it is, you've got to defend it?
Yeah,
Brian.
I mean, City's defending wasn't great, nor was the goalkeeping for that. I think more often than not that is given as a free kick. I'm not necessarily sure that it definitely was, but I don't think you can argue too much about that. I mean, you know, City scored in the League Cup final from a corner that shouldn't have been given, you know, last week. You know, these things happen.
These things happen.
I thought for me, I felt much more stronger than that. I think the Fred one was a pen, no?
Yes.
Yeah. That looked like a penalty to me.
Do you think, because I thought it was, had they got it right, it would have been VAR working, because in real time, it looked like a massive dive. Yeah. And when Mike Dean booked him, I thought, that's a good decision. And then you saw it again, and you're like, I can see why Mike Dean made that mistake. And you wonder if the VAR in the pecking order of referees was like, oh, I can't be bothered to piss Mike Dean off. So
maybe
I'll just let it go.
This is how, I mean, that's a great example of how VAR should have worked. I mean, that should have been a quick sort of fella in the Stockley Park going, Mike, you might want to have a look at that one. And Mike does a theatrical jog over to the monitor and has a sort of big dramatic look at the screen. And then he does his big gesture.
And
it's a penalty.
It anyway.
I mean, that should have been what happened. And it just wasn't what happened. And that's frustrating.
I'm still not sure when they look at the monitor and when they don't. As far as I can tell, they don't look at the monitor for that kind of thing anyway.
But they should.
We shouldn't underestimate McTominay's finish. I know it was a mistake.
Oh, it's a
very well executed, that, isn't it? Yeah, of course.
Seamus says, which panic purchase is better, my 24 tins of chopped tomatoes or Manchester United buying Odion Ighalo?
Time will tell, Max.
Ighalo, it will for both, but Ighalo looks good, doesn't he?
I'd rather have Ighalo than the 24 tins of tomatoes.
Of course he would, Mark.
Of course you're a meat eater.
Yeah. No, he came on and I thought he did a very...
cans of Spam. How do you feel about it now?
No, I don't eat. Only high quality stuff. But I thought Ighalo did well when he came on in terms of holding the ball up and giving a physical presence to United when they weren't able to really get out in terms of possession. They were obviously starting to feel the pinch in terms of sort of becoming tired, and to just be able to sort of hit slightly longer ball up to Ighalo, and he can then you know, hold the ball up and bring others into play. He's doing well at the moment, no doubt about that.
Up next for them, they play LASK in the Europa League, last 16 on Thursday. LASK 6 points clear at the top of the Austrian league. Kickoff is at 5:55 p.m. Chelsea 4, Everton 0. Two goals in either half for Chelsea. Mason Mount, Pedro, Willian, Olivier Giroud. 20 passes in the build-up to the opening goal. A lovely turn from Mount, wasn't it? Willian with a great finish. Pedro's lovely finish for that great through ball from Barkley. Which was your favourite goal, Philippe? You were there?
Yeah, I was there, and I really, really enjoyed myself, and I was talking with people who follow Chelsea week in, week out, and said that it was, in their eyes, the best performance of the season, and actually perhaps best performance for a couple of seasons in terms of attacking play, certainly. And I think I have a fondness for the second one, the Pedro goal, if only because the movement, the players who were involved, so that's Gilmore, Giroud, Barkley, Pedro, when it's for the conclusion, every single one of these players played the ball first time, which was just absolutely ravishing to watch. They were absolutely magnificent. Magnificent. It's extraordinary. We talk about the impact that Bruno Fernandes has got on Manchester United, and rightly so. He can be a catalyst. I mean, I think many people will think, can he be a Cantona for Solskjaer? But similarly, the impact that the return of Alonso and Giroud has had on this team, it's extraordinary. Like suddenly, hey, hello, I think people have been asking for it for a while. Azpilicueta is playing on the right side. Yes, great. We've got a left-sided player on the left side of defense. Yes, great. We've got somebody who can hold the ball, is very clever in his distribution. Fantastic. And then we've got the little boy, Billy Gilmore. I mean, he was the star of the show.
And he was so good against Liverpool, and you thought he can't. It's going to be so hard. That, you know, the difficult second album, right? And I know that wasn't his debut against Liverpool, but everyone is now watching how he would do. And Mark asked an interesting question to you, Philippe, before the pod, which is you get a different view in the ground. Mm. Does he? And Mark, your question was, does he appreciate the space?
I mean, because I think that's so important for players that play in that position. Mm. You know, how are they moving off the ball when the camera's maybe following the right back, but is he looking to find, you know, the angle for the ball off of Azpilicueta or Rudiger or whoever?
Yeah, and every time, it was all the time he was looking for the so-called pocket of space, making himself available, and you could see that he was placing himself, that there would be angles of passing available for two or three of his teammates, which is pretty impressive. The confidence of the boy on the ball is astonishing. Receiving the ball under pressure, being able to pivot first and to choose the right option, sometimes it would be a pretty difficult pass to the right-hand side, Willian in particular, or it would be a simple sideways or backward, and always taking the right decision. And with a calm and a willingness to earn the ball, to get the ball, I always consider earn the ball at his right, and which shows a kind of courage that you don't very often see in players in this position, never hiding.
And he looks like he's been doing it for years.
Yeah. Well, he has, but not with this kind of team.
It's not the second time he's ever played football, we should be clear. But also when he's, you can just see in his sort of demeanour and the way he's yelling at players who are so much more experienced. You know, after the game, and he's interviewed with Giroud, and it does look like Olivier's brought his son to the game, doesn't it?
It looks also a bit like that when Eden Hazard met a basketball player.
That was true.
There was a bit of that with Giroud and Gilmore, I thought, with the little and large combo.
So what does this mean? Chelsea are good now.
They were excellent, yes. What it means is that I think the blip is over, basically. And we were too enthusiastic, perhaps, for them in the autumn when they had all these wins and with all the young players. Then perhaps we were a bit too dismissive when they were fine. It was a bit difficult. And also, to be honest, Lampard, I think, was struggling a bit with knowing who should I play, how should I play. And now he's got something in place, which amazingly is in place with Kante, Jorginho, and Kovacic not playing.
I think we maybe also have to say that Everton were very accommodating.
Aaron says, how can Everton stop from Evertoning?
Yeah, I mean, Ancelotti will hope, I suppose, over the summer to bring in maybe some of his own players and try to instill a mentality in them, because they've lost all of the big matches away from home again. You know, they have got in a successful manager now, but I mean, it was a wide open 4-4-2. You know, with two absolute forwards in Richarlison and Calvert-Lewin, Bernard and Sigurdsson on the wings, Gomez and Davies in midfield. It was quite easy for Chelsea to pass through them, and I'm not sure what other options he really had, but maybe.
But it is the sort of flat 4-4-2 thing, which is just weird to see in this day and age. Because I remember,
but it's been working. I mean, it's been working for them, hasn't it?
I guess it requires a lot of work behind the ball from the strikers. One of them, I mean, I thought it was strange that one of the strikers just didn't go, okay, this Gilmore kid is sitting deep there controlling stuff. I need to be on him every time he gets the ball. That logically, to me, one of the strikers should just be doing that. If not, you need at least one of the wide players to come inside a lot, and I guess maybe Sigurdsson you'd look to, but they just looked so flat, and it was so easy for Chelsea to find angles. It reminds me of actually when Mourinho first came to England, and he spoke about how so many teams in England play 4-4-2, so if I have like Makelele at the base and two in front of him, then we can create triangles and we can play our way through anyone, and it's really easy. I can't believe we're back to this again. It's like almost 20 years later.
I think Jose's saying if he could just have Ndombele at the base,
we'll get on to that. To be fair, Ancelotti did mention post-match that they weren't compact enough. I mean, he didn't go into specifics. He did charmingly say that everything was bad, I think, which is a good analysis. But he mentioned that they weren't compact enough. And I guess if you're going to play like this, you need to really compress the space between the parts of the team.
Right, to Anfield. Liverpool 2, Bournemouth 1. Goals from Salah and Mane. Getting the Reds back to winning ways. 22nd consecutive league win at Anfield. Did anyone start to think at 1-0 that the great choke was on, Mark?
not the great choke. No, obviously
just
not.
Just a tiny bit.
It was a weird performance, I felt, from Liverpool in that first half. I think the lack of tension is harming them slightly, because the crowd, it was very quiet, and Klopp was trying to, you know, get Anfield going. And it felt just like for so long they've known they're going to win the league, and they kind of celebrated winning the league in those games against City and Manchester United at home. There was, you know, those were great moments, and this just now feels like we're just playing out the season. And they need to improve a lot, I think, to beat Atletico Madrid. I think that they will. I think that the atmosphere will be completely different, and they did still win the game, I suppose, but it wasn't a great performance from Liverpool again.
That Bournemouth goal, that old-fashioned shoulder barge, brackets, massive push in the back by Callum Wilson. Once again, I do ask, and I don't expect any of you to know the answer, how is that not a push?
I think we all agreed that maybe, you know, Fernandes, we don't quite know. This one, I think we all know what it was. It was, my goodness, a foul and a half.
Just great, again, the fella, it's extraordinary. The fella just watching the screen just go, Paul Tierney, just trundle over to the monitor there. Like, you might want to have a look. You might want to have a look, but I don't know, maybe not.
It's bizarre, but I mean, how? Surely they look back and go, oh, you know, it's better not to do it in the game that happened in that other game than they decide actually they shouldn't. They should have given a foul. Don't do that during the match. But what's happening in Stockley Park?
Do you think it's something like people are suddenly, I don't know, never held a guitar? I'm thinking of that because there's one in the studio today. Mm-hmm. And they're pushed on the scene, on the stage, and they were perfectly capable of playing the guitar when they were warming up. And suddenly, wow, there are people around me. I don't know what to do anymore. Do you think these guys in their caravan or their truck or whatever.
It's a room.
It's a room. Mm-hmm. Do you think that they're thinking, oh, shit, oh, shit, oh, shit. There are millions of people waiting for me to take a decision. And they panic. I don't know. Mm-hmm. They freeze. I don't have any explanation. This was so obvious.
I do wonder if Gomez committed the grave sin of not falling convincingly enough.
Which is annoying, because quite often when a defender, you know, attacker is pressing a defender who's got nowhere to go, and then the defender just slows down and then just hurls himself on the floor and gets a free kick, when it's definitely not a foul.
No.
And this time Gomez doesn't and should get a free kick. Look, Ake had a great chance at 1-0, and that does change it slightly. And that clearance off the line from James Milner.
It's just amazing.
The man can't do.
The only position he's never played in is central defence, I think. All the other, he's played every single position as an outfield player. And I think he should be tried at central defence. If only to be able to say later on when he retires in 27 years' time that he's actually played in every single position.
Yeah, and do 5 minutes in goal.
Yeah.
Atletico Madrid on Wednesday at Anfield. They're 1-0 down. You say, Mark, you were saying you think they will win. I mean, how's Atleti's form at the moment?
They drew 2-2 with Sevilla on Saturday. I think that the performance they gave in the first leg, we haven't seen too much of that Atleti, you know, all season, really. I think the early goal really helped them in that regard. We also saw last season that they collapsed in similar circumstances away to Juventus, and I think Liverpool would do enough to win the tie.
It will be very different at Anfield, and if Liverpool play with the same kind of intensity that they showed in Madrid, they'll go through.
Right, that'll do.
The intensity, which by the way has been missing from every single of their other games since then.
That'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin looking back on the other Premier League games, which we will try and build up into some sort of excitement.
Oh my God.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. First of all, to say shame on you, Angus Mackay, who writes, Max, your weeks-long advertising campaign of William Shatner's show has piqued my interest, and I've booked my tickets.
Oh no,
for William Shatner. Hashtag Team Shatner.
I mean, that is disappointing.
Angus, let us know how it goes. To those of you who hear the pod before coming to the live show in Glasgow tonight, look forward to seeing you. And then those who we'll see in Edinburgh as well on Tuesday, thanks very much for coming. 23rd of March, Earth in Hackney, me, Barry, Lars, Flo Lloyd Hughes, In Leeds on April the 9th, Neil says, regarding Bielsa coming to the live show in Leeds, surely he would send someone to spy on the show from an advantageously positioned hill. Yes, me, Barry Wilson, and one more. Okay, then, to Binary Code Saturday. And we begin, I mean, we sort of go in any order you want, but we start the Emirates. Arsenal 1, West Ham 0. I mean, it shouldn't have been Binary Code because West Ham should have had two or three, shouldn't they? Is this one that got away for them?
Possibly. It was a pretty poor game in which West Ham were not that bad. That's the way I would describe it. And Arsenal were back to Emery football, passing the ball laterally, not doing much with anything, but with the Arteta touch, which is to win in the end, which is what Emery didn't do. It was honestly very underwhelming, especially coming on the back of an excellent performance against Everton, which was a cracking game, and this was the very opposite of it.
I always want Mesut Ozil to be brilliant, so I can be occasionally guilty of overplaying anything he does. But when I saw that assist, I looked at it and thought, I think there are so many players that just wouldn't have done the perfectly simple thing like that. But am I just overstating what is just a cushioned header?
I can tell you that the reaction in the stadium was not that at all. It was, what an absolute plonker. Why didn't he hit the ball? Because, of course, Sean Massey's flag went up. And then it was found that he was onside by a toenail or something like
that. And actually, the absolute highlight of this game is David Moyes' comments after the game, saying, maybe next year that goal won't count. What? Not sure why. And then he says, I think we've got...
What?
I know. It doesn't make any sense at all. Then he says, I think we've got one of the best referees in Europe refereeing the game. Two excellent linesmen, referee's assistant, Sean Massey put her flag up, who had good games today. I'd have trusted their decision. Well, of course you would, David. It's just total math. Like what? I mean, I know sometimes at the end of the game a microphone is thrust into someone's face. But and I know, look, I don't particularly want VAR, so in my world that goal wouldn't have stood. But this makes no sense. Next season that goal won't count. How, David? Explain it to us.
Maybe you're suggesting VAR might be rescinded.
Well, I mean, that's the only possible way, right?
But yeah.
Total madness, but great. To say that with a straight face, I would trust these officials on a decision that it's patently was wrong.
It's not football anymore, Max.
Anyway, Southampton 0, Newcastle 1. The Gineppo red card does everyone think, yes, it's a red card, yes, he didn't mean it, yes, we feel sorry for him, but he still has to go?
I don't feel overly sorry for him. Feel sorrier for the defender that sort of had the studs into his calf. But, I mean, you know, we've been some mocking of VAR, but that was a good use of the system, really.
Yeah. Dwight Gayle had a few chances, didn't he? And Newcastle got that penalty after Boufal's handball inside the area. Alex McCarthy, who saved the penalty, had an absolutely brilliant game. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you think, how it's not right that he was on the losing side.
Unfair. Very unfair. Yeah. But it is unfair.
It is unfair. I guess life is unfair, Alex, isn't it?
Yeah. Southampton are a weird team, though, aren't they? Because they look so good at times, and then when there are games that you expect them to win, I know there was a red card, but even before the red card, Newcastle have had sort of more chances than they normally create in matches, and they've dropped a lot of silly points at home, Southampton, where they really should be sort of higher up.
Hasn't Hootel has talked about it several times, because it's just like everybody scratching his head and wondering what exactly is wrong when we play at home. And I think that if you look the way their season started, they had, honestly, their schedule at home was really, really tough. They had some top teams coming at the wrong moment. It was also still trying to find some kind of defensive organization. As a result, the difficulty of the fixtures, the fact that the team wasn't quite balanced and settled yet, they lost a lot of points. And then the pressure started to build and on and on and on. And actually, they came back into the fight by their performances away from home, which increased the... what people were expecting from them at St. Mary's. And so you've got this weird concatenation of circumstances, which means that they don't feel at home.
Weirdly, they're the worst home team in the Premier League, but actually the sixth best away team. So, like, right up there with the big boys away from home.
And, you know,
just dreadful at St. Mary's.
Not sure what Jan Valery is doing there. I mean, Sir Maximum is an exciting and fun player, isn't he?
But, he's great.
But you could... either just, well, just don't do that, I think, is my advice.
I mean, I don't often say this, but I thought Steve Bruce made a really good and salient point after the match about it is a bit of a dying art what an X-Men does. Mm. I mean, having players who have the ability, but one thing, but they have the confidence and the license to just take people on, you just see less and less of it. And I remember a few years back, I spoke to the father of one of these sort of incredibly talented youth prodigies who had spent hours and hours and hours of his childhood perfecting, you know, swerves and step-overs and chops and things, like really methodically, and just until he could master everything and do it in games. And then he got a move to a huge club with a very highly rated academy. And in his first training session, it was like, no, one and two touch. Like, you're not allowed to dribble. And it was like, what's the point of this? And I think we see a
were
lot of...
Were you talking to Mr. Tarap?
No. But I think we see, and that won't be true at every academy, sure. Far from it, but I think we see a lot of these sort of talent factories where it seemed like they want to churn out like a bazillion sort of tidy central midfielders. And we don't see the sort of the enjoyable madness of Saint-Maximin. There's not enough of it.
Burnley won, Spurs won. Here's a Richard Jolly tweet you will appreciate more, hopefully. Historic day for Spurs as they finally bring up 1,000 league draws. They've been...
Some weapons grade jolly.
Yes, they've been stuck in the nervous 990 since April 2018. They did get a draw. I mean, the first half, though, Burnley were great and Spurs were abject. Chris Wood got his 11th of the season, best ever top flight tally for him. The XG for the first half, I know you like this, Loz. Burnley 2.12, Spurs 0.12. Oh,
Jesus. I thought it was going to be a negative XG.
Now, Jose made a double substitution. We'll get on to how he treats Tanguy and Ndombele in a second. Do we have to give him some credit, Mark, for making those changes? I mean, everyone seems to be gasping.
No, because you could see before the game that was no way to set up. I mean, Tanganga and Vertonghen as wing-backs with three centre-backs and Skip in the team. I mean, that's just...
Sounds quite Burnley-ish.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even think Burnley would set up that defensively against Burnley. He can say that, you know, there's a couple of problems with tiredness and the squad is stretched at the moment. Both of those are true, but you can't do that. And he had to change it at half-time, and they improved a lot in the second half. And I think one of the reasons was that players just felt a little bit more comfortable, Tanganga and Vertonghen particularly.
How did Burnley not get a penalty when Davinson Sanchez pile drives Chris Wood?
I don't know. It's bizarre.
It's ridiculous.
And again, it's put me into this terrible position of kind of agreeing with Sean Dyche about, like, you know,
anything.
Yeah. No, I mean,
he's done a great job, hasn't he, Dyche? I mean, look,
yeah,
Burnley,
no, he hasn't. We're joking, but he really does.
Tenth in the league, they could have gone above Spurs, and they probably deserve to win this game. And considering where they were a while back, this run of form,
they had
been
a very
tremendous.
Good chance actually of winning it just at the end.
Mm. Mm-hmm. They really did. Mm-hmm. Lo Celso makes a huge difference to Tottenham, doesn't he?
You say, you know, Lo Celso doing in the Fernandes role as a catalyst. Mm. Yeah, he does. I mean, he's got imagination. He's got a fantastic technique. And to be honest, people have been knowing. We've known that about Lo Celso for a very long time. We're still waiting for him to do this on a consistent basis.
So, talk to me about Ndombele, because I know when he came to the Premier League, Philippe, you were so excited. And
he's a super talent.
And you know, Jose afterwards saying in the first half we didn't have a midfield. I'm not speaking of Skip because he's a kid of 19. So then you look around and you look at the other players that he took off and it is just Ndombele. He says, I'm not going to run away, and I have to say he has had enough time to come to a different level. I know the Premier League is difficult. Some players take a long time to adapt to a different league. But a player with his potential has to give us more than he's giving us.
Yeah. Well, what can you say? That is... the fact that he took him off at halftime, I don't think anybody has much to say about that. And when it happened, when I heard the comments by Mourinho, it made me think immediately of the difference in man management between Jurgen Klopp and Jose Mourinho. Why? Because I was thinking of when Jurgen Klopp took Dejan Lovren off. I think it was at against Tottenham, actually, in the 36th minute or something like that. And the way he behaved towards Lovren afterwards and basically made him understand, made him feel... You know, this is, don't worry, you'll be back. You know, I'm with you. I'm not crucifying you. Mourinho has crucified Ndombele.
But hang on.
In public, that is totally out of order.
But Jose, when he did the same with Eric Dier, didn't he, in the Champions League, and I know and he wasn't, and he was supportive. I'm just trying to think of a vague defense. When he bought Dyer off, he said, look, I had to do that to change the game, and it did change the game.
Yeah, but that's fine. You can say that. Yeah. You could say even things such as, he really wasn't well. He wasn't playing at his normal level. I had to change something. That's fine.
Yeah.
But when you say after that, basically, he's not good enough. He has made... That's what the message was. Mm. He hasn't made the effort to adapt himself to the Premier League. He obviously is not pulling his weight in training, and he's not going to play again this season. This is what he said.
So I agree with you. I don't think he should do it publicly. But do we agree? We don't know what is... You know, everyone's a human being. We don't know what's happening with Ndombele, but he's not giving enough on the pitch. There could be a myriad reasons for
when
it.
When you know how much talent he's got, what he can bring to that particular team is, you know, he's still quite a rough diamond, but the qualities are there physically, technically. He's an excellent player. So yes, it is frustrating, but you shouldn't do that. Sorry.
I wonder if there's more that we just don't know. You know, it takes time to settle in a foreign country and all those things.
There were fitness problems too.
Yeah, but I mean, even against Norwich in midweek, he came on as a substitute and looked as tired as anybody.
Well, in which case, don't pick him.
No, I mean, absolutely.
It's bizarre. No, and also the comments, it looks as if, and you know, Mourinho is really looking at Leipzig, thinking we can do something there. And what he explained is that he'd picked the team more or less thinking about the game in the Champions League, wanting to have fresh legs for that very important encounter in Germany. Which is, perfectly all right. No problem with that. But if he really is that crap, don't pick him.
Do we give Spurs any hope against Leipzig?
Not much. And also, just to complete that from Philippe, don't pick him next to a really inexperienced kid.
Yeah, as well, yes.
With five centre halves behind him who spend the entire half launching it long to a striker who's not a striker. Like, this is not a recipe for success under any circumstance. It's bizarre stuff. And I don't know. Yeah.
Tuesday night?
No, not. I don't. But the only thing is that Leipzig's having a bit of a wobble as well. I mean, they dropped points against Leverkusen last weekend. They dropped points against Wolfsburg this weekend. The defensively rugged Wolfsburg that didn't get past Timo Werner was rested for that one. I think Leipzig are a better football team. Look more a coherent unit. I think they'll be fine.
Palace 1, Watford 0. Palace up to 39 points. Jordan Ayew's 8th of the season. The difference in this game, took the goal well, didn't he? Because he had to get it out of his feet and it didn't look like the shot was necessarily on. Ben Foster was very angry with his team's defending for that. And we should credit Roy Hodgson. Great stat from Duncan Alexander. Roy Hodgson is 127 days older than the Bernabeu. And he's just signed a new contract, hasn't he, Roy? Good for him, eh?
Yeah, yeah. It had been on the cards for a long, long time, and people were starting to wonder actually if it was going to happen or not, because I think the talks started in November. And to be honest, yes, it's a pretty... it's a no-brainer as far as Crystal Palace is concerned. And by the way, Jordan Ayew, I think, has surprised quite a few people, and I have to raise my hand here. I didn't think that he would be that efficient and that useful for Crystal Palace. Yeah, I was wrong.
I've got to say, that was a really good goal. I mean, when you watch it a few times in the replay, he got a lot of power on that from, like,
no backlift.
Really good.
I was at the London Football Awards on Thursday night. The table next to me had Ben Foster, who won Goalkeeper of the Year. Mm-hmm. Very nice man. Mm. And I had Jordan Ayew there, who was on his phone for the whole evening. And I was speculating that maybe at sort of 5 in the afternoon he'd rung up to try and change his energy supplier, and he was just on hold for the whole... And I think he'd gone for goal of the season. Like, that was the only reason... The only thing he was up for was that lovely goal he scored. Mm-hmm. And then... Obviously, Heung-min's son won goal of the season, so it was a wasted trip for Jordan Ayew, but I hope he had a nice time. Sheffield United 1, Norwich 0, 10th clean sheet of the season for Dean Henderson. Chris Wilde saying, I'm not sure why Dean Henderson was man of the match, he only made 2 saves.
The tongue was firmly in the cheek there.
do we approve of Dean Henderson doing his sort of wild dives when I think it was Buendia put one about 100 yards wide, and then Dean Henderson does a comedy dive, which I like, great for the fans. I just think it might come back to bite you.
But I think he is that kind of character, and I think that helps him become the goalkeeper that he is at the moment. But I think Chris Wilder, maybe what he was talking about there in terms of the man of the match, is that if you then read that in the newspaper the next day, it gives the impression that maybe Norwich have totally dominated the game, whereas it was just one kind of moment, really, where with the triple save that made sure that Sheffield United got the point. So maybe
it was a great scramble, wasn't it?
It was fantastic. And you just wonder at what stage the Manchester United just start one, you know, you're wondering who should be their number one goalkeeper. It's a great position to be in because you can park Henderson, you know, on loan at Sheffield United maybe for another
knowing
season.
That their number two is not bad either, by the
no,
way.
No, absolutely. Exactly. So
probably the best number two in the country. Who doesn't get a game?
Billy Sharp, lovely header for the goal.
Oh, beautiful.
And Oliver Norwood, who I was watching him a bit, and he's a really clever footballer. And he plays, we talk about, you know, Fernandes playing forward passes and tricky passes. There are two or three occasions in this game where he's got the ball in centre mid, and you're looking at it for pretty much every centre mid would just play it out wide. And he plays these little balls inside to feet, which really open up the player, really help. And I suspect Sheffield United fans will know that they have a lot of players there who we don't watch week in, week out, who are really quite talented. And I suppose a fear for them is what happens in the summer. Does Wilder manage to keep hold of all these players?
I think Henderson is going to be a big, big question mark. Mm-hmm. He's been absolutely, I mean, he's one of the players of the season.
Wolves 0, Brighton 0. In the Football League. no, there was only one shot on each half at Molineux. Proper's shot from distance drew a routine save from Rui Patricio. Jimenez hit a shot on the turn straight at Matt Ryan with 15 minutes to go. Thrilling stuff. That's all I could pick out. Brighton's still the only team in the top four leagues yet to win a game in 2020. How much do we fear for Brighton, Mark?
Well, their next two matches are Arsenal and Manchester United, so you know it could get worse before it gets better. But I feel like the clean sheet will have done them the world of good, actually. And it wasn't quite as defensive as when Chris Hughton went to Molineux last season and got a similar kind of performance out of Brighton. This felt like they deserved a draw and a way to Wolves, mm-hmm. limit them to one shot on target. Even though Adama Traore didn't start, I think is a good defensive effort because they've been a little bit vulnerable at the back, and they're not scoring goals. They're creating chances, they're just not scoring goals. So I felt like just moving backwards, making them solid, it's kind of the classic thing that teams do when they're in this out of form relegation battle. That's
a classic Chris Hughton.
Yeah, but it wasn't quite as defensive as what Chris Hughton.
I was talking to a Wolves fan on Saturday saying. He was worried about the game because they have what's known as the Aaron Moy complex, which is, they just, whenever Aaron Moy plays against Wolves just descend into nothingness. There's nothing they can do.
I had no idea this was a thing.
Well, it's only for Wolves. I think when he was playing for Huddersfield last season, he absolutely bossed two games against them. Huddersfield won both those games. So in many ways, a great point for Wolves to overcome. The Aaron Moy complex, which will be the third of the Detective Wilson books that I write. Tonight at 8 in the Premier League, Leicester City versus Aston Villa. In the Football League and the Championship, Leeds were the big winners. They went top of the league after a 2-0 win over Yorkshire rivals Huddersfield. Luke Ayling scoring an absolute banger straight off the training ground. And it culminates with, I'm not saying it's Van Basten level because he's not as wide. The cross isn't as hard to strike. But even still, to be not quite Van Basten is praise enough to Luke Ayling. They leapfrog West Brom, who drew 0-0 at Swansea. And Leeds extend the gap on Fulham, who drew 1-1 away at Bristol City. Brentford back up to fourth after hammering Sheffield Wednesday. Forest and Preston both lost at home. At the bottom, it is so tight. Huge wins for Stoke and Middlesbrough over Hull and Charlton. All the three sides in the relegation zone are the three that were promoted from League One last year. But Hull have now lost four on the bounce, haven't they, Mark?
Their form since the end of January when they lost Bowen and Grosicki has been absolutely horrendous. They were in mid-table at that point and they've got just a huge game coming up. They've got Charlton next. So a game really where if they lose that one, you do really worry for them.
In League One, Coventry now 5 points clear at the top after a 1-0 win away at Ipswich Town. Second place, Rotherham lost 3-1 at Rochdale. There are only 3 points between Rotherham in second and Wickham in eighth. In League Two, a change at the top. Crewe overtook Swindon following a 3-1 win over bottom place Stevenage. Swindon lost 2-0 at home to Forest Green, with Plymouth winning 3-0 over Macclesfield. They're just a point behind both of the top two. Cambridge United lost their second game in a row, 2-1. Leighton Orient. In the She Believes Cup, Lionesses have one win and one defeat since Thursday's pods. Last night, Ellen White came off the bench to score a late goal against Japan in their 1-0 win. It looked to me, Mark, like they had all the chances. Japan really desperate to play it out from the back, fatally on a number of occasions.
Yeah, and eventually got caught out with Tony Duggan crossing for Ellen White to score the only goal of the game. I think it was a deserved win and a much needed one for England. Phil Neville under big pressure following 60 feet in nine. The big talk in the camp has been, can Beth England and Ellen White play together up front? Phil Neville has said he prefers to play with just the one centre forward. There were big calls for Beth England to come into the team, which she did. Missed a couple of chances, and then White came on and scored the winner. But I think that's...
Does it paper over the cracks? I mean, because on Thursday they were comfortably beaten by the USA, but losing to the USA is no crime because, you know, they're the best team in the world. But there's just a lot of talk about whether Phil Neville has a style. What is his style? Does he really answer any questions about what his... he says he's going to die on his sword before he changes his style, but nobody knows what it is.
No, I mean, there were these questions, going into the World Cup, and they still remain, and he's very odd in his press conferences afterwards. I don't think he gives clear answers. He's quite condescending in the way that he speaks to some of the journalists as well, as to how he's got this great, plan and idea about the game, and seems to speak down to people quite often in terms of the women's game. But it is, what he's saying is that he's trying to bring through some younger players, and with that, with this next cycle, there will be inconsistencies in performance, and I suppose he's building up to bigger tournaments to come.
Fitbar Corner. Celtic maintained their 13-point lead at the top of the Scottish Premiership. They thrashed St Mirren 5-0 at Celtic Park. Rangers go back to winning ways with a 1-0 win at Ross County. At the bottom, another good one for Hamilton, followed up their win at Ibrox with a 1-0 win over Kilmarnock on Thursday. Rangers at home to Bayer Leverkusen in the Europa League. Scottish people will see you all tonight and tomorrow night. And that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll talk to Nicky about how the coronavirus has affected Serie A, and we'll talk to Sid in Spain too. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's start discussing Serie A with Nicky Bandini. Nicky, how are you doing?
I'm good, Max. How are you?
Yeah, really good, thanks. Headlines obviously all about the coronavirus. Some games behind closed doors. Italy's sports minister accusing Serie A of being irresponsible for ignoring his calls for football to be suspended completely because of the coronavirus. How does it feel with the weekend's game? And I know it's conjecture, but what do you think will happen?
Well, I think, I've been plenty critical of Italian football's governing bodies over the last couple of weeks, but I think Vincenzo Spadafora, the sports minister who you've just cited there, is, I think he's being a bit unreasonable slightly with this comment, because he on Thursday was saying, he on Thursday basically gave the decision, handed it down, that no games should take place with a crowd before April 3rd. He said everything behind closed doors. So that's his decision on Thursday. Now, on Saturday, you had this extraordinary unfolding situation, Saturday night even, sort of going into Sunday morning around midnight, where a leaked government document got out saying that they were thinking of putting all of Lombardy, this huge region which includes Milan, millions of people, under quarantine. That got out by Corriere della Sera, and the government, perhaps in response to it getting out, pushes ahead and enacts this legislation, which, completely puts, a huge and economically huge part of Italy under quarantine. The next morning, Damiano Tomasi, who is the president of the Italian Football Association, writes to the heads of government, to the heads of various sporting bodies in Italy, saying, as a head of the Football Association, it's time to stop playing these games. We're getting advice from the government that we shouldn't be touching each other socially. How are you expecting people to play football in this circumstance where obviously you're going to touch each other? And so at 12:30, basically, Vincenzo Spadafora says, right, I think we should, Tardi's right, we shouldn't be playing these games. But you've got a game kicking off at 12:30. So Parma Spal, they've got players in the tunnel ready to come out on the pitch, suddenly sent back to the changing rooms for an hour and 15 minutes, not knowing whether they're playing or not. Now, yes, you can say at that point, maybe it would have been the smartest thing just to stop and cancel everything. But I do have at least some sympathy in the sort of immediacy of this situation, not necessarily in the big decisions that have been made, but in the immediacy of the situation, to the people trying to run football who say, look, all these teams for another weekend running, this keeps happening, have got to the stadiums, they are there, they are ready to play. What is the benefit now to not letting them play the game and get on with it? So it's a mess. that's a huge mess. What happens next, there's going to be an Italian Football Federation meeting on Tuesday, and so far most of these decisions about what's happening have been made by Serie A, the league. This is obviously the Football Federation, which holds jurisdiction over football as a whole. And my expectation at this moment in time, given what Tomasi has said, given that there was even some sort of rumours going around, although denied, of strike action from players, given that you have now had, I think, four players at least in lower leagues who've been diagnosed with coronavirus, I think football is going to stop. I think it's going to be put on hold altogether and indefinitely until there is certainty about this sort of containment of this virus and what's next. But I am saying that as conjecture. That is my opinion. There's going to be confusion, and frankly, the way this has gone over the last 2 weeks, there may be a decision that gets changed a day later, because that's what it's been, back and forth constantly. But that's my feeling right now, is that we're headed to a firm stoppage of football altogether in Italy, which is extraordinary. It's unthinkable. It's going to create an impossible situation, because there is no room already to delay games on the calendar. And I think this is the beginning of a much, much more European conversation that's going to happen about Euro 2020 and football as a whole going forward.
On the pitch then, the Juve-Inter game, I mean, what a goal from Paulo Dybala.
What a goal, wasn't it? I know. It was, because I mean, watching these games was such a surreal experience. And I remember, you know, I remember after the Inter Ludogorets, you had Antonio Conte saying, you know, as manager, it felt less like a game than a training session. But Inter, Juventus Inter on Sunday night, to me, even without the fans, that still felt like a real game. The fury was there, the competitiveness was there, the sort of the atmosphere was bizarre, but you could really hear the managers and the noise of the dugout, even on the TV feed, because there weren't even many journalists allowed into this game, by the way. I think it was about 50. The goal itself, which was already 1-0 to Juventus at that point, Aaron Ramsey scored the first, was just wonderful. Dybala takes the ball on the right wing from a big crossfield ball from Bentancur. First touch brings it inside. Ashley Young at the same time controlling it. 1-2 with Aaron Ramsey again. And then the last sort of little shift from one foot to the other to beat Young for a second time, and then finish it with the outside of his left boot into the bottom corner. It was just so, so well executed. It was very, very much a goal worthy of winning the Derby d'Italia, this game that is a huge fixture every year, was, I would say, the biggest addition of this fixture probably in the best part of two decades, because it's the first time you've had these two teams both concurrently going for the title at the same time. And frankly, you know, with the proviso that I can't say what's going to happen to the end of the season, but if the season does reach a conclusion at some point, this was a huge result, because Juventus are now 9 points ahead of Inter. Inter do have a game in hand, but yeah, it feels that this particular season, that even with that game in hand, that is a pretty daunting gap for Inter. Not necessarily the end of the title race, because Lazio is 1 point behind Juventus, but certainly a big blow to Inter's ambitions.
Nikki, thanks so much for coming on.
Anytime.
Nikki Bandini there on Serie A. While we're on the coronavirus, sports governing bodies and broadcasters have been called to a government meeting on today in the UK to discuss the staging of events behind closed doors if the coronavirus outbreak worsens and mass gatherings are banned. Also on the table will be the broadcasters talking about whether games might go free to air if they're behind closed doors, etc., etc. We'll obviously report what happens in that meeting. On Thursday's pod, let's go to Spain and La Liga and Sid Lowe. Sid, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, tremendous. And hey, Liga.
Yeah, hi, Liga. Hi, Liga, yeah. It's bonkers, isn't it? I mean, basically, there was obviously the discussion last night became one of, is anyone any good? And who's going to win the league? And actually, this fits. Remember, we were talking about this in the build-up to Clásico, and that comment from Jorge Valdano when he said, you know, the Clásico is like a race between two men with a limp. And I suppose that's what the title race is.
So Real Madrid's, they limped the most at the weekend.
Yeah, neither of them were very good. I mean, Real Madrid were worse than Barcelona this weekend. Barcelona at home against Real Sociedad, and they won 1-0 because of a penalty given by VAR, which the referee hadn't seen, for a handball. They won 1-0 and didn't impress. Messi scored. Real Madrid went away to Betis, and Betis, who had been in trouble, they'd not won for six games. They were starting to look over their shoulder, wondering whether relegation might be a possibility now when they've got a team that should be good enough to challenge for a European place. And actually, Betis started the game really nervously, and you thought, well, you know, as soon as Real Madrid take a step up here, they'll win this. But bit by bit, Betis got into the game, got on top of them, scored an absolutely brilliant goal, and then gave away an absolutely absurd penalty. The same guy, and he struck the ball brilliantly on the goal, and he did almost the same to Marcelo for the penalty, just booted him up in the air, completely misjudging it. And this was Sydney, the brilliantly named Sydney. They're 1-1 at half-time, Betis, and you think, well, that's it, it's gone. But it hadn't. They were far the better side. 1-2-1, deserved it. And Madrid are off top again, having gone up there last week.
The race for the top four is... Can you look down to seventh? Am I getting too optimistic to hope?
No, I think you might be able to. I mean, you look at it and obviously, look, Atletico Madrid should always be in it, in that race for either third or fourth place. Sevilla are definitely strong enough in terms of the players they've got to be in that race. Real Sociedad, I think, are probably the best team in Spain at the moment in terms of how well they play, the kind of football they produce. And then you've got Getafe, who are the best team in Spain at the other end of the scale. It's a totally different style of football. It's much more aggressive. It's much more direct. It's got a very different focus, but they're absolutely brilliant at doing it. And I think all of those teams, there's no doubt that all of those will feel that they've got a chance of getting one of the two Champions League places.
We've talked about it a little bit on the pod already, but what are Atleti saying going into this Liverpool game?
Well, Atletico have drawn their two games since they beat Liverpool. The first half, at least against Sevilla at the weekend, was pretty wild. It was a lot of fun. The ball going backwards and forwards, a couple of slightly doubtful penalties, and there's a big shout for another one as well. They don't have the solidity that they've had in the past. The weird thing at the weekend, I suppose, was them scoring twice. But then, you know, we said this in the build-up to the Liverpool game, and Saul had said this. We interviewed him for the paper, and he had talked about how. I mean, he didn't quite say this explicitly, but I think it was implicit in what he said, and I think we saw it in the game against Liverpool. But I think what they almost needed was, if you like, the excuse to be defensive, to be the old Atletico, to be able to get a result. Now, of course, they've got a 1-0 lead against Liverpool. There's perhaps even more reason to do that now and to look at a kind of commitment and effort and an organisation above creation to try and be the team that they once were. Because, as we've talked about lots of times, they're a side almost with a kind of an identity crisis, doubts about the way that they should play, not just whether they should play well or poorly, but whether they should attack more or defend more. And I think against Liverpool, we'll see a bit of the old Atletico. I think they'll be tough and they'll be aggressive and they'll try and cling on to that lead. Although that said, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a kind of a 15-minute splurge when they try and get the goal, which would, of course, change absolutely everything.
If Spain goes into lockdown, you got enough ham, Sid?
Yeah, I've got enough ham. I don't know if I've got enough bog roll, but I've got enough ham.
Is there any part of the ham you could use for that particular?
I mean, I suppose if you kind of stapled a sponge along the bone of the ham, you could.
It's got a handle, hasn't it? I suppose
exactly. You hold onto the trotter and you staple a sponge at the other end, and there you go. You're laughing. I mean, it's yes.
Well,
it's,
if needs must, Sid, we know you'll be all right.
Well, it is. In football terms, of course, it's starting to happen. Valencia against Atalanta will be behind closed doors this week, including journalists. There's no journalists going either. The entire stadium will be closed doors. There's been suggestions over the last few hours that Barcelona's game against Napoli will be the same. And obviously, the focus is on Italian clubs coming here. But I don't doubt that at some point this will be expanded to Spanish clubs as well. I'm not a doctor of that sort, so I don't really know whether this makes sense or not. But I think it's coming. Yeah.
Sid, thanks for your time.
Pleasure. Cheers.
Lovely to talk to you as always, Sid Lowe, out in Spain. Time now for image that you all now have. I enjoyed it. It's time for Lars's Deutsche Football Rundfunk.
Deutsche Football Rundfunk.
Willkommen.
Jawohl.
Wie geht's, Lars Sivertsen?
Indeed. Some stuff happened in Germany this weekend. We had Borussia Dortmund winning again away to Mönchengladbach, and obviously going away to Gladbach is tricky, that's one thing, but it was also the second week running where it kind of felt like Dortmund avoided a banana skin. This is a Dortmund Roman, who under Lucien Favre has made walking into these banana skins and falling down on them into quite an art form. So seeing them get out of Gladbach with 3 points, I think that would be heartening to their fans. What was less heartening was that Bayern won again, making slightly harder work of it than you'd expect against Augsburg. Augsburg, not a good team really, but they made a proper fight of it. And really sort of retro goal for Bayern with the first one with a long Boateng ball being sort of kicked in by Thomas Müller. It's a real throwback type of goal, but you know, good that they won in the end. And for me, actually, the biggest story of the weekend wasn't so much the football, it was the banners. It was all about the banners for me. Mm-hmm. And I do recommend tracking the journalist Felix Tamzut on Twitter for this. He's writing for Deutsche Welle about like German fan things. He's a good man to follow for this sort of thing. And he's been sort of doing a good job on Twitter putting together examples. So we had the Berlin fans, or some of them anyway, I should stress, these are all sort of ultra groupings who are putting up these fans, putting up these banners. The Berlin fans said, bribes, collective punishments, dead people in Qatar, it's clear to us who's football's ugly face, which is a reference to Rummenigge, who called the protest against Dietmar Hopp football's ugly face. Rummenigge, of course, is the CEO of Bayern Munich, and there were protests very much against by their own fans. The Bayern fans saying the very ugly face of FC Bayern is shown by those who take blood money from Qatar, and also saying if you say you're against discrimination, how could you sign a sponsorship deal in Qatar? Yeah, very eloquent banners. The RB Leipzig fans also turning on their own, which is good to see, because their club incredibly ejected a group of some 20 Japanese tourists over supposed coronavirus fears. It's pretty scandalous behaviour for RB Leipzig there. Wow. And they're being told so by their own fans. The RB Leipzig fans had a banner saying, RBL, if you want diversity, you must call racism what it is, no acceptance of structural racism. So good on the RB Leipzig fans. Not everyone's favourite fans, but, you know, good on them. The Freiburg fans had a banner saying, insulting billionaires for you is a scandal, slavery in Qatar, you couldn't care less. So, I mean, you're sensing a bit of a theme here from the German fans, pointing out that there is some hypocrisy going around.
It's interesting how much more political they are.
Yeah,
when you own your own clubs, it makes a difference, doesn't it?
Yeah,
the clubs have to listen.
And I should stress, I mean, I say this and that club's fans. I mean, they are ultra groupings who are making these fans. It's not a collective effort for every single game. Is that, but yeah. And also, points for creativity to the Duisburg fans. They're down in the third tier, but they held up a banner and said, either we win or we'll hold a banner about Hop. So, you know. that was the theme of the weekend. I think some terrific efforts from the banners, pointing out that there has been some hypocrisy in the DFB's response to the whole Hopgate thing.
Oh, well, look, I enjoyed your Rundfunk. Thanks so much, Lars.
Anytime.
France.
There's more, but I'll just leave it there.
Just leave it there. Philippe, PSG's visit to Strasbourg became the first game in Ligue 1 to be cancelled due to the coronavirus. Yep. The Alsace region is been hit particularly hard. Yeah. So elsewhere, second place, Marseille drew. And Rennes stay in third, thumping Montpellier.
Yeah, 5-0. It's all coming good for Julien Stéphan, and it confirms as well that it's going to be a bit difficult for some of the more fancy teams, shall we say. And after a moment when Rennes, you know, they had really inspired a lot of hope because of the way they played, because of the personality of their coach, they had a little wobble, but they come back. And excuse me, they're now in the third position. And to be honest, they look very well placed to qualify for a Champions League, if there is a Champions League, of course, which is another thing. Because at the moment in France, we are also in the same. I mean, the measures have been taken, as in gatherings of more than 1,000 people have been basically postponed or cancelled. So obviously football games fall into that category. At the moment, we are not too sure what's going to happen for the PSG Dortmund game, by the way, because you could think that you would play behind closed doors. That would be okay. Unfortunately, it's not just a health problem, it's also a security problem. They fear that some fans would regroup outside the stadium and would create actually just as much of a problem, if not more of a problem. So it's now the police who are probably going to take the decision whether the game goes ahead or not. So there you go.
We shall see.
Just a word about Lyon. They've only got 40 points after 28 games, which is their worst return since 96-97. So, which is pretty bad for a team which... is you know, fixture in the Champions League and still in it, by the way. But they are really in a bad way with Rudy Garcia.
In Argentina, Carlos Tevez scored the crucial goal as Boca Juniors secured the title on the final day. Boca went into the game 2 points behind arch rivals River Plate, but as they drew 1-1, Boca took advantage. 20 seconds on FIFA and Infantino for you, Felix.
Just a little, just to let you know that a report from the Swiss Justice Department has been leaked, and in which it appears that a very, very close friend of Gianni Infantino had a secret meeting with the Attorney General before Infantino declared for the FIFA presidency, in which basically Infantino, it is alleged, of course, via his old friend, asked if everything was okay. Was he perhaps one of the targets of the investigation? So that's, which is pretty bad, to be honest, in terms of behavior, especially knowing that Gianni Infantino also met with the Attorney General, Michael Lauber, 3 times in secret after that. So it could be interesting, shall we say.
More importantly, Rich says, regarding misheard footballers, I always thought it was Hugh Sabio. what a player Shug was, he says. Ben, a slight correction to John Bruin regards the typewriting and logo at the end of the A-team. It was Stephen J. Cannell, not Glenn A. Larson. Thank you, Ben. Clarence asked, did you get your heating working, Max? No, I just turned the oven on. I'll work it out when I get back from Scotland. And we should say that because we recorded so early, Lars likes, before the pod, to have a Subway. But you had to. You were waiting outside the door like a Subway fan, like a computer game being released for the first time, like meeting someone on the red carpet. There you were, knocking on the door, battering the door down of Subway.
Gonna need that turkey breast and turkey ham sub, Max.
How delightful. Well, that'll do for today. Thank you, Lars.
Thanks, Max.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Max.
Thank you, Philippe.
Thank you, Max.
See you in Scotland. If not, we'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.